No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, retired United States Senator Michael D. Brown, and I'm here with my co-host, Liberty Jones, an amazing college student who we hope will add a whole new aspect to our show because we need to talk to younger people. And we have a very special guest today. Today we have Kaylin Free, an old friend of mine who's just an amazing person. Kaylin is a former elected district attorney. She's a citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. She represents Oklahoma as a national committee person on the Democratic National Committee, and she's running for vice chair of the Democratic Committee, and we're so happy to have her here today. Thanks, Kaylin. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Senator. It's my pleasure to be on the show with you and Liberty.
Let's start with why you're running for vice chair. First, let me say that vice chair is a very important position. When I was at the DNC, many of you know I was a DNC staffer for 4 years. And when I was there, I was in the chairman's office, Chuck Benat's office, when he took a phone call and he said to me, "We're going to have this housewife from California, but she's a lawyer and she's really accomplished. And her dad was a mayor of Baltimore and a member of Congress. And her name is Nancy Pelosi. And she's going to do very great things. And she's going to be a vice chair." So vice chair is a very important position. As we all know, she's going to do great things was an understatement because Nancy Pelosi was really an amazing politician, an amazing Democrat. So now tell us why you want to be the next Nancy Pelosi.
Well, I tell you, those are big shoes to fill, and there will never be another Nancy Pelosi. But the reason I'm running for vice chair of the DNC, and we'll talk more about during this interview about my background, but the catalyst, I'm going to just jump forward a little bit, the catalyst that spawned me, that caused me to throw my hat in the ring for vice chair, happened last October, September, October, and November of 2024. In last fall, and really all last year, I worked my heart out, dedicated my hours and hours of my day to helping elect the first African-American mayor in the city of Tulsa, Monroe Nichols, 41-year-old state legislator. Very few people thought that Mayor Nichols could win that seat. I was one of the few that thought we could and knew we could. And we ended up winning with only 13% of the population in Tulsa being African-American. He was running against a white woman, 71 years old, who was part of the establishment. And Mayor Nichols and I and a few others of us went up against the establishment. I've worked in over 300 campaigns, raised over $25 million, have been very successful in red states, blue states, and purple states. But this was the first time that I literally had doors slammed in my face. And when I started calling people, when we were approaching the general election, and I had a poll, and this was a legitimate poll that I could show folks, I've never seen a poll so clear in my entire career, that showed that when we got our message out, that we were about to elect the first African-American mayor in Tulsa, and nobody cared. And so I started calling my friends at the DNC. I've served, done two tours of duty on the DNC. One was from 2005 to 2009. I was appointed by then-chairman Howard Dean to one of those coveted at-large positions. Then I came back 5 years ago and ran for and was elected to our singularly national committee person in Oklahoma. So I have a lot, and like I said, I've raised lots of money. I have a lot of contacts, and folks in the D.C. elite, the consulting class, the DNC, did not want to help me. Not only did not want to help me, they did not help me. I ended up, through other mechanisms, raised about $200,000 directly into the mayor's campaign, and then I raised another over $600,000 into an independent expenditure. And we won that race. But we won that race without a single bit of help from the D.C. elites and from the DNC. And so after November, when I was still, euphoric about winning the Tulsa mayor's race, but like the rest of Democrats in the country, despondent about watching us lose the White House and control, a friend of mine said to me, "You need to run for vice chair of the DNC." And because of the experience that we had just had in Tulsa. So Mayor Monroe Nichols, that experience, what I learned in that race, and is the reason that I'm running, because I know that there are brilliant, charismatic Monroe Nichols all over America, people of color, people of working class, that can win these races, can win these seats, and all they need is for the DNC to find them, lift them up, and show them the way.
Well, let me first say that I believe that's true, and I also believe that it takes one to know one, and you certainly are a real person, Kaylin Pree. I've worked on several campaigns with you. We worked on on Indian reservations together. We worked in training together, and you're one of the most solid people I've ever met, and that just, you just exude that when somebody meets you. So I think you're doing exactly the right thing. And I got to tell you, I ran the first program at the DNC to give money to the state party through direct mail. And there were people at the state party level that didn't even want to deal with us. They hated the DNC so much because they had never reached out to them. Now, this is 40 years ago, but the DNC has a lot of problems reaching out to people. So I think that you're exactly the kind of person that they need, because that's exactly what you do best. You want to, I don't want to monopolize the time here. You got something to say, Liberty, about this, about the DNC and what you hope happens as a young person?
So hi, I'm Liberty. I want to say first that I really commend you for all of your work. I did some research yesterday, and you being the youngest person to work at the Department of Justice and you creating the Indigenous Native American Network is something so beautiful that we need to see more of. And I want to emphasize one of your points, that the system that we currently have in place is failed. In many different spheres, we're focusing on all of the wrong things. We are kind of plaguing ourselves for a better future. And that's why it's so beautiful that we really need to rework this and really need to involve all of America, whether that be all different races and colors and voices, and also all of what America has encompassed, which is freedom, freedom of law, freedom of religion, freedom of all of those things. And it's so sad to see a system that's been doing so wrong for a little bit now, not wanting better change. And so I really admire you even more for seeing those flaws and for wanting to do something about them, no matter how hard reaching those goals are. I just really commend you. I was doing some research on you last night, and I was like, wow, this is what I stand for. This is what I believe. And I think we need to understand as a whole that if these laws and the system we had was working, we wouldn't be here right now where we are.
Well, that's an important point, I think, is that the Democrats have to take some responsibility, a lot of responsibility, for what's happened. And let me ask you, Kaylin, let me just ask you another question. How important is it that you be the first Native American woman to ever hold this position? How important do you think that is?
Well, I think that's important, and this is what I tell folks. If I were just another Native American running for this position and didn't have the background that I have and the experience that I have, the connections, the solid record that I have, that's not a singular reason to vote for me and to support me. It is historic. I am the first Native American to run, I believe, for vice chair of the DNC. And I will be, when I win, the first Native American to serve in that leadership role. But as Liberty was saying, this is not an either-or proposition. This is addition. and bringing more voices to the table, more diverse voices to the table, people who've never been at that table before, is what the Democratic Party is all about. And that's why I think it's important to have a diverse body politic, not just in the campaigns we're running, but in the folks who are leading the party.
Well, you know, I believe that's so true. And the first decent job I ever had in life, Kalen, was as a Teamster. I lied about my age and I became a Teamster truck driver after working for 4 years full time at the age of 14. I got a job at 17 driving a truck, first sick leave I ever got, first benefit. My business card still carry a union bug. And I watched the head of the Teamsters Union, a union that had never even attended the Republican convention, I watched the president of the union give a speech for Donald Trump, and I couldn't believe it. So what do we need to do to get working class people? How the hell does a guy that's a billionaire convince people that have to work every day to make a living that he feels their pain? What do we have to do to get those people back?
So I want to answer that question, Michael, Senator, but I would like to share, if it's okay, I'd like to share a bit of my background with you. So you mentioned I'm a citizen of the Choctaw Nation. I grew up on a farm on the Choctaw Nation Reservation, Oklahoma. I grew up feeding cows and hauling hay. I worked a graveyard shift at a convenience store to put myself through college. I went to classes the next day smelling like the donuts that I had spent the night making. I graduated from law school owing over $100,000 in student debt. I lived in a trailer house with no running water while I studied for the bar exam. And as Liberty mentioned, I spent the first 10 and a half years of my career at the United States Department of Justice prosecuting corporations for polluting our air, our land, and our water. I moved back to Oklahoma, and I was the first woman and the first Native ever elected district attorney in southeastern Oklahoma. After 13 years in public service, I finally paid off my student loans. I tell you all this because I know what it's like for working people who are struggling to get by, the people who no longer believe that the Democrats are fighting for them. Because growing up, I was one of those people. For the first time in American history, the majority of folks out there believe that the Republican Party is fighting for working class people and not the Democrats. That's an absolute narrative that we must flip. You know, I'm sitting in a state, you know, in a red state that many people can identify with. I know what it's like to be overlooked and to be ignored by the DNC and the consulting class. The fact of the matter is that the blue wall has crumbled. We are losing, as Liberty said, the people who have been the backbone of our party for decades because we've ignored them. There are rural parts in every state in America, and we can't win battleground states if we can't win in rural America. And we can't win if we don't listen to people. And I'm angry that we're losing simply because we're being ignored, and that's why I'm running for vice chair of the DNC. I will never forget the challenges that working Americans face and the importance of showing up and listening in every community, no matter how small. But to rebuild our party and to keep that Teamster president off the stage at the Republican National Convention, we must commit to connecting with working-class Americans. The working-class Americans, people of color, the people have been the backbone of our party for generations.
Yeah, I agree with that. And let me just say to anybody that's listening, this is the kind of woman that can do this because she's the real deal. I've worked with her, and we just had amazing success. We campaigned on Indian reservations, remember, John Kerry. And we won. We won the state of Minnesota. Unfortunately, he did not win the election. But we worked hard, and you're an amazing organizer and just an amazing person. Liberty, you want to jump in here? I don't want to close you out. Well, that's okay. You don't have to jump in. We can let Kalen continue to speak. But go ahead, Kalen. What else do you have to say?
Well, I am so glad that you brought up Minnesota. And in 2004, the Senator and I did go. That's where we met. We met in Minnesota. Yeah. We both volunteered on the Kerry Edwards campaign. Like you said, we worked the reservations, and I know he'll remember this because it's a very fond memory for both of us. That's where we met Ken Martin, and that's where we met Peggy Flanagan. Ken Martin was the campaign manager for Peggy Flanagan, who's now the lieutenant governor, the only Native American woman to serve as lieutenant governor in our history. But 20 years ago, Peggy was running for her very first seat. She was running for school board, and we knocked doors for her, and we helped her. She won that seat. She later went to legislature, and now she's lieutenant governor. And I actually talked to Peggy's endorsing my campaign. We spoke a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about that first race that she was on. And we both know that had she not won that first race, she probably wouldn't be sitting in lieutenant governor's house today.
That's right.
And that is why it's so important for us to build our bench. And the reason that the Republicans are in the position that they're in is because we lost our party when we let the Republicans develop a strategy to win races down ballot all over this country, and we failed to respond. And that's why races like Peggy Flanagan's for school board 20 years ago, Mayor Nichols for the mayor of Tulsa last year, are so critically important. Everyone wants to think about the White House, and especially after yesterday. And yes, we want to win the White House back, but we're not going to win that White House back in 3.5 years if we don't do the work now to rebuild our party in every state and start working down ballot races, expand the map, invest in real infrastructure, and rebuild our grassroots.
And that's always been the case. When I was at the DNC, we fought because the Republicans had training academies and had all sorts of down ballot stuff, and we weren't doing anything. And as a person that was a consultant for 25 years to DNC, I can tell you the money is in the White House for us, for the consultants. That's what motivates them. That's what brings them to the table. So you're right. The paradigm has to change somehow for the result to change. So, and Minnesota was an amazing experience. And Native Americans, if you have not interacted with Native Americans, you really don't understand what amazing people they are, right? They're just amazing people. They've had all these horrible things done to them over the years, but they're still out there working hard, and they believe that tomorrow's going to be a better day. So, it was a great experience for me, and I think that Peggy is just one example of people I want you to talk for a second about the training, because how important is the training? I remember that we had candidates when you had your training academy. We had candidates we had one woman from Alaska who was running for Congress who, when we asked her to give a stump speech, she stood up and she said, "I want to run for Congress because I want to make my community better." And by the end of the week, and nobody really responded to that, but by the end of the week after we trained her, she told the true story about how she brought her wounded son home from Afghanistan and what motivated her to run. And there wasn't a dry eye in the place. So training is really, really important, right? Because it's a steep learning curve to campaign.
Absolutely. I mean, and the reason, Indians List had the success that we had, we helped elect 63 Native Americans across the country. We elected the first Native American woman to the Pennsylvania State House, the first Native American woman to the Washington State Senate, the first Native American woman to win statewide in Montana, the first openly gay man to serve in the Oklahoma State House, later the Oklahoma State Senate. And lots of firsts. And we worked in red states. We worked in Alaska, North Dakota, South Dakota, Oklahoma. We worked, we were omnipresent. But how did we win those races? And the senator just spoke about that. We had many campaign camps, day one and two day campaign camps. We had 4 and 5 day campaign camps. And we gave our candidates, and not just our candidates, we also trained hundreds of staffers to work on campaigns. We gave the candidates and the field organizers the tools that they needed to run sophisticated, modern-day, data-driven campaigns. And then we also taught them how to fundraise, and we raised money for them. Indians List was modeled after Emily's List, and we were wildly successful. But the reason, again, that we were is because we focused on giving our candidates the skills that they need. And, you know, and I still do that. The Indians List, you know, we shuttered the door 6 years after we started, only because I said if I ever win the lottery, you know, it was a labor of love for me, and I became legal counsel to the Cherokee Nation chief. However, the folks that we trained, and you know, they stand on the shoulders of Indians List, and that recipe works everywhere. We actually had non-Indians come to campaign camp. They had to pay their own way. We had a district attorney from Oklahoma County, a Democrat district attorney, beat an incumbent Republican DA, and he came to our campaign camp. So the training is essential, and that's exactly the kind of work that the DNC needs to be doing across this country.
Yeah. I remember we even had a member of parliament from New Zealand.
Exactly. Yep.
To one of the training camps.
I
remember it because he told the most amazing story about how his career was started by Desmond Tutu and just mesmerized everybody in the audience. And then I got to speak after him. And I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to say? I've never met Desmond Tutu. But anyway, it was an amazing experience and just an incredible success. And all because of you, Kaylin. You were not only the person that organized and put it together, but you were the soul of it. And it was really amazing.
I just pulled up a list of it. Now, we played in other states, but here's a list of the states that Indians List played in and won in: Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Missouri, Montana, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, Washington, and Wyoming.
And that's so important to your campaign to run for vice chairman, because this is exactly what we need, you know, and the blue wall is crumbled. There, you know, there's several states in the blue wall that, you know, used to be in the Democratic, you know, it used to be in the Democratic column for years, and they've been lost. Let me ask Liberty a question. If, you know, how do you feel as a young person, Liberty, that we've elected Donald Trump and that the Democrats have fallen on their own sword? What do you think needs to be done?
So, you know, that's a really great question, because that's the issue that we're dealing with right now, is kind of understanding where did this pendulum shift, where now, you know, she mentioned the working class is no longer supporting the Democratic Party. They're no longer feeling like the Democratic Party is giving them what they need. And that's why it's so important to me, and I think to the youth that I surround myself with, that we really rework the Democratic Party, that we rebuild the trust that we're looking for, that we feel like our voices are actually being heard, because if they're being heard and supported, then we will want to advocate for them, and we will feel like in our future we'll see policies that not only unite the United States as a whole, but give all of our population a voice, instead of just limiting the power that Trump takes away from that, you know what I mean? And I feel like we've reached a point where it's really like crazy, like unfathomable for me to understand how the majority of the United States feels like someone like Trump is better representing them and all of their voices, you know what I mean? And that's because we have to rebuild that trust. You know, Kaylin said that we need to focus on getting the candidates what we need, what they need. We do, but because if we do that properly, if we focus on getting the candidates what they need, and they're better represented, we're able to give the people what they need, you know, whether it be policy or whether it be education. And as a whole, I feel like these voices of color, you know, it's a really large percentage of the United States that is not being represented, whether it be in policy or whether it be in taxation or whether it be in whatever. We've been silenced. And Trump is kind of like a leading role image of how we've been silenced. in all these spheres, in terms of nature preservation, in terms of indigenous land, in terms of people of color who really need help right now, who are creating the backbone of America, who is bringing this land of the free that we've stood firmly on for so long, we've been silenced. And that's why we need to rebuild this trust with the Democratic Party. We need to rewire the inner workings, and we need to actually have voices there that are going to represent this pain, because currently the people we have there do not understand this pain. How will they feel the passion to represent it? And I'm sorry for going off, but this is something I'm very passionate about, because this is something that I saw really wrong in a lot of countries internationally, and I don't want the United States, which is such a beautiful and free land, to get to that level. And that's why I admire the work that we're doing right now, because I think this is the future and this is the hope for unity that we need.
Well, and I think, you know, that very well said. And what do you think about that, Kaylin, that what are we going to do? What do you need to do when you become a vice chair to kind of change the direction of the Democratic National Committee?
Well, at Liberty, I really appreciate what you had to say, and especially speaking from someone from the younger generation. This evening, sometime, I'm not sure what time it is, I'm actually addressing, there's the vice chair, the vice chair candidates will be talking to the Youth Council, the Young Democrats, this evening, and I'm sure we'll be talking about some of these issues. And, you know, we say, and I say, that the people of color, working men and women, youth, are the backbone of the Democratic Party. And I said earlier, you know, that we have forgotten that. We've lost our way. All of these constituency groups are very important. People of all ages are very important. We can't take any Democrat for granted. But I see a lot of times what we do, especially with our young people, and I've seen it in campaigns for 30 years, is we take young people for granted, not just as voters, but as campaign volunteers. And I have the pleasure of working with young people every day because of the races that I work on. There's no off year. And the senator and I can tell you that the races, that the campaigns that we worked on, not just 30 years ago, but even 10 years ago or 5 years ago, the tactics that we used back then are completely different than the tactics we use today. And yeah, it's the young people who stay on the cutting edge of technology and communication and help us win. And so listening, I'm not just talking about from a policy perspective, because Liberty raised very, very important issues there that are important to young people. And we can all say that certain demographics have issues that are important to them. But, you know, we know that if I go into on an Indian reservation, that I am going to be typically better received. We know that if Liberty knocks on a person that's under the age of 35's door, she's going to be better received than someone who's, you know, 61 years old like me. It's just like the old labor to labor calls. It's, you know, that's right. Why we do. That's why they do labor to labor calls. So this is a cumulative effort. One thing I want to point out is, you know, someone shared on Facebook this morning, and I pulled it up and saved it. You know, less than 32% of the people voted for Donald Trump. Almost 31% of the people voted for Harris, and 1% voted for a third party. 36% of the people did not vote. This is not a landslide. It was not a mandate. Now, he's taking it as a mandate, and he's going to do destructive things to our democracy and all of the things that we care deeply about. But when we look at the fact that 36% of the people didn't vote, we got to think about that. When I was in Detroit last week at the DNC forum, I went to a rally for One Living Wage, and I listened to the service industry workers stand up and talk, and it resonated with me because I've been a service industry worker. I've been a waitress. I worked for $1 an hour with tips on top when I was in high school. Yeah. And there are 14 million Americans that are working in the service industry. And I think she said less than 12% of them voted. Why should they vote? Well, first of all, they're working two or three jobs. They're not, you know, into this like Kaylin and Senator Brown and Liberty are. we have the luxury of being involved and caring about this. These are people who are struggling to get by. But are we doing the work? Are we as Democrats showing them that we care about them, that the policies that we are you know, enacting in Congress or at the state level is actually helping them? The reason that I'm successful in the races that I'm in, especially nonpartisan races, is that we talk to people about the issues that matter to them. We say, we're going to make your life better. Here's how we're going to make your life better. We make their life better, and when we run for reelection, we say, we just made your life better. And that's what the Democrats have to be doing, and that's the message that we have to be carrying.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And a few weeks ago, we had Marianne Williamson, who's running for chair of DNC, on, and she also talked about a new vision for the DNC, and how important it is to get that message out there. You know, I think Marianne was very frank with me when she said she doesn't expect to win, but that doesn't matter. We have to get the message out there. There has to be a new vision. I very much believe in that. So let's talk about the work that needs to be done with the assumption that people are smart enough to elect you. I know that they will, but what are the things that we really need to do? We need to train people, obviously. We need to find people. And what do we need to do to restore hope? Because, you know, I have grown children. None of them think about buying a house. None of them, you know, they think that's totally out of their reach. I have a daughter who's a tech person that makes a lot of money, whose boyfriend also makes a lot of money. They're kind of looking to buy a house, but they don't think they can. You know, I never doubted when I graduated from college, never doubted that I would have a good job, that I'd be able to afford a house someday, that I have a wife and a family, all these things that seem to be elusive right now to young people. So what do we need to do to restore hope to people, do you think?
Well, I think that the issues that you're raising there are, I was with a group of friends day before yesterday, and they were telling me that for the first time in American history, you have over 50%, and I don't remember what that, I think the age group was 18 to 29, over 50% of I'm going to call them kids, I guess I should call them young adults ages 18 to 29, even with college degrees and skills, are living with their parents. And that right there is, there's no more stark example of where we are in this country and the economy and where we are than the fact, because you know that most kids, most young adults don't want to be living with their parents. They're doing, and I know that that's happening with people who are gainfully employed. The young adults are gainfully employed. But like you said, it's not about buying a house. They can't even afford the rent to move out. I mean, our granddaughter is living with us, and she has a very, very good job and has a master's degree, and she's, you know, lived with us for 2 years. We love having her there. We're not trying to push her out. She's 25 years old. But and that's in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So, you know, but how do we as a DNC address those problems? Those are policy issues. Those are issues that can only be fixed through legislative action and through leadership. Our job at the DNC is to build the infrastructure and to allow us to win races, to put more Democrats on the D side of the aisle than on the R side of the aisle so they can start addressing those issues. One of the things that's been very interesting to me in the last 6 weeks is this has been a steep learning curve. I have learned so much about the DNC and its failures. And I'm talking, and I'm not going to be able to talk to every member, even though I'm making calls and working 18 hours a day. It's just impossible because, you know, some folks aren't answering the phone and they're busy or whatever. But the people that I am talking to, the DNC members I'm talking to, without exception, every one of us are frustrated. And I'm talking to people, and every time I talk to a DNC member, I'm like, well, how long have you been on the committee? How long have you been a member? And I'm talking to people who've been on 6 years, 10 years, 12 years, 30 years. Yeah. And I'm hearing the same refrain, the lack of transparency, the consulting class ruling the DNC. We don't know where the money goes, all of this. And so there are systemic problems at the DNC that, and we know there's going to be whole new leadership. I mean, there may be some officers who are reelected, but we're having a new DNC chair. We know that. We're having four new vice chairs. We know that change is coming. And what we have to make sure of is that this new leadership capitalizes on that change. One thing I want to say is, you know, the consulting class is getting the living hell beaten out of them. And I work with consultants every day. Here's a trite thing. Some of my best friends are consultants. And, you know, I was raised on a farm, and my dad told me this adage, you know, when I was a kid. Kaylin, there's always enough for the pigs. There's never enough for the hogs. And I say that, and I've never said that in this context, but I say that because about 3 weeks ago, I called a consultant I hadn't talked to in several years, and I said, hey, you guys are getting the hell beat out of you by these DNC candidates. Tell me about that. And he said, Kaylin, he said, if there is not a Democrat consultant who did not get filthy rich this last election cycle, that's their fault. He said, there was money being flushed down the toilet here. Okay, well, as a fundraiser, as a political operative, as a former candidate, as someone who works her heart out day in and day out for candidates, to find out that we are flushing money down the toilet is beyond shocking to me. And we saw it. I mean, you know, we saw it happening, except I had blinders on. I'm thinking, well, my goodness, if we're able to put Kamala's image on a sphere in Las Vegas, then that means we've done everything we can possibly do in Pennsylvania. No, that's not true.
Well, you know, it's absolutely the case. And I was at the Democratic Convention. Liberty was also a student activist at the Democratic Convention. And we were, you know, it was a big old pep rally. I'm sure you were there, too.
I was there. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was an amazing pep rally, right? We all came out of there feeling good and jazzed up, and we were going to do it. And I think that's part of the shock that's gone on, is that we just can't believe that this man who is, look, my dad was a con artist. He was just like Donald Trump, but on a smaller level. My family was always moving to avoid whoever, the bill collectors, the authorities, whatever. And I can tell you, this guy is nothing more than a two-bit thimble rigger and a Ponzi scheme guy. And you know, he's out there now selling crypto, for God's sake. He's the president of the United States. But we really got our ass kicked by these guys, and a lot of the blame needs to lay on the national organization, which you're absolutely right about. You know, I was a consultant for 25 years. I'm also somebody that got rich at it. And so you're absolutely right. You know, it's got to be more than just playing to the, you know, preaching to the choir, which seems to be what we do. Is, don't you think we do too much preaching to the choir and not enough reaching out to people that don't agree with us?
Absolutely.
Well, jump in here, Liberty. I know you have something to say.
So I think it's really interesting points that you guys are both bringing up. You know, you were talking about how only 36% of people did not vote, which means that all of this money, you know, we were flushing down the toilets could have been directed towards that, you know, and it makes me so upset because is it possible to rewire the system when there are so many people profiting off of these failures? You know what I mean? And it really shows and emphasizes the importance of having new methods there. You know, you even said yourself with your own election, you need these young people to help you realize the new tactics and how the candidacy world is evolving. And it's like, how are we able to really evolve the Democratic Party if we're not allowing space and if corruption is trumping the space for these new tactics and new voices to really achieve and evolve to the evolution of the American population? So my question to you is, you know, is it possible to rewire the system, and what does it take? What does it really take to stop these failures and to stop this profiting that's taking away from our success of that 36% of people?
Those are good points. And as you were talking, I was thinking about this. I look at budgets, you know, all the time. I look at budgets for campaigns, and I can look at a budget and go, "Wait a minute, well, you know, why are we, you know, spending that? Why are you asking that we spend that much money on direct mail or on digital or on field organizers or on this or on that?" And like I said, everyone needs to make a living. Everyone has to make a living, and we pay our people who work on campaigns, you know, a living wage, and pay them well. And consultants, again, they're not evil. Most of the ones I work with are very good. The consultants I work with share my values, but there's overhead, and I understand that. But when you have, like I said earlier, you know, what the consultant told me is people are getting filthy rich. That's just wrong. And that money, you know, I mentioned the Mayor Nichols race. I'm not going to disclose where I got the money. I raised $107,000 from direct for an independent expenditure, raised $107,000 through my internal network. And then I got $500,000 from an individual to run this independent expenditure. But when you're in that field of, you know, you have to, donors look at, and I look at, as a campaign professional, how are you going to spend that money? Is that money going to be effective? And what is that, how is that money going to be utilized? And is there, you know, is there grift? Is there graft? Is someone have, you know, being greedy with that? And you got to make sure that you meet your budget, you meet your goals, and that, you know, that you are communicating your message. And that's what you're saying, Liberty, is these folks that stayed home, didn't vote, you know, why didn't they? Is it because our message was wrong, or is it because somebody didn't reach out to them, somebody didn't offer them a ride to the polls? There's all sorts of reasons why. But that's what's got to be looked at. We've got to be running smart campaigns and investing our dollars wisely.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And I want to ask you, I just came from Jimmy Carter's funeral. I worked for Jimmy Carter on his 1979 and 80 campaign. I got to see some old Carter people that I worked with. It was a lovely occasion. And there was a real outpouring of love for Jimmy Carter, which surprised me a little bit that it was so universal, because I worked with him at the end of his campaign. He was not very well liked. He was not very well liked when he left the White House. But I think there's this longing for somebody with his spirit, right? We all admire the fact that when he left office, he never stopped working. We had a woman on our show 2 years ago that attended his Bible study, his Sunday school class. He was still teaching Sunday school at 98 years old and building houses for the poor. And, you know, he's so, in terms of his spirit and who he was as a human being, he's kind of the anti-Donald Trump. He cared about the people that were around him, which is something that I have to say I've always admired about you as well, Caitlin. But so it seems to me that the spirit, the need or the desire to bring that back is out there, and we just have to find a way to tap into it. What do you think about that?
And I'm so glad you mentioned President Carter. I actually went to attended his Sunday school class a few years ago myself. And, you know, you're talking about a man who sold his peanut farm when he went into the White House. I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got him with all the other problems. You got a man in the White House who won't even turn over his tax returns, who,
right,
you know, profits his family, the Trump organization, profited last time, and they're profiting, will profit this time. And you got Jimmy Carter, who left the White House, or went into the White House and had to sell his peanut farm. So, you know, there he is one of my absolute favorite presidents in history. And because of his selfless character and what he did, not just when he was in the White House, but after he left the White House. I mean, he will go down in history as in a well-deserved place among our leaders. And there are people out there, I think, who share that compassion for those who are less fortunate, who have the ability to connect and to identify with the Democratic values, and those are the types of candidates that we need to be finding and lifting up.
And, you know, there are a lot of, we see it right now, right, in places like Los Angeles, where people are just coming out to help. They're losing everything, but they're still there trying to help their neighbors. First responders are still showing up. People are still, you know, a lot of people, even Trump people, you know, I think we forget this as Democrats. When it gets down to a personal level, they want to help each other. They want to be more like Jimmy Carter than like Donald Trump. So I think we need to tap into that. Well, we're running out of time here. I want to give Liberty one more chance to say something if she wants. And then I want to ask you, Kaylin, to talk about anything you want for the next 5 minutes that we haven't talked about. Do you have something to add there, Liberty, or you?
I would love to say one more thing. You know, after this conversation, I'm feeling really hopeful for our future, but also, you know, kind of confused as to how we're going to achieve such big changes when there's such a big shift, you know, in the ways that we're connecting to these democratic values, in the way that we're seeing the democratic branch. And so my question to you, Kaylin, is with all the time and focus that you've spent kind of on rebuilding what Jimmy Carter stood for, you know, how can we strengthen, you know, in policy and government, you know, however this resonates with you, how can we strengthen our commitment to these democratic values like equality, justice, and cooperation, and genuinely focus on supporting and uplifting all members of society, especially those who are marginalized, especially, you know, all of the communities that we need to encompass in the political field? What is our first step to really strengthening that bond that I feel that we're starting to lose?
Wow, that's an excellent question. And, you know, I think that now, just taking just a step back, knowing what we are going to endure for the next 4 years, I think the community is more important now than ever. I was on a Zoom call last night with the officers from Democrats Abroad. And we were and they have some unique challenges, obviously, living, you know, the people I was talking to were in Serbia and Toronto and London and Korea and the Netherlands, Belgium, all those places. And so we were talking about how important, and I was saying how important it is for us to have community with one another and, you know, to get through this. But we also, I'm speaking to myself here. I have a tendency to surround myself with like-minded people. All my closest friends and the folks that I hang out with are all Democrats, just like I am. I, you know, have a tendency to shun folks who have opposing views. We can't do that, because what we know is that most Americans, people want the same thing. We all want, like the senator said earlier, everybody wants to live the American dream. Kids want to be able to have a house. They don't want to be living, you know, they want to be able to have good health care, breathe clean air, drink clean water, you know, go to a good school, not live in a crime-riddled neighborhood, not worry about their kids getting shot in when they send them off to kindergarten. We all have those basic values. And we need to realize that we're more alike than we are different. Now, with that said, let me say that Donald Trump, 8 years ago, exposed an underbelly of America that we knew existed, but we didn't realize that it was as deep and as broad and as strong as it is. And I know there are people who voted for Donald Trump who don't feel this way, but I also know that there are racist, misogynistic people who support his policies. And those are the folks that we are never going to be in community with, that we are never going to agree with. People who, you know, are bigots and racist and misogynist don't have a place at my table because they don't want me at their table. I'm not going to be able to convince them that they're wrong, and they're not certainly not going to be able to convince me that they're right about those issues. But there are broad swaths of Americans that we're not talking to that are, like we said earlier, are just struggling to get by. Those are the people that need our help. Those are the people that we need to be talking to. Those are the people that the Democratic Party needs to be reaching out to. And some of those people have been in our camp for generations. We still, people want to say, well, we lost African American men and Native Americans didn't vote like they did in the past and all of this. That is true. The fact that all of these demographics voted at a lesser percentage than we voted in the past is shocking, but we still have the majority. And what we need to figure out is, why have we lost? Why did our numbers go down in these demographics? And how do we get them back? And like I said earlier, we get those people back. We have to earn their trust. We have to listen to them, and they have to realize that they're important to us, and we are fighting for them.
And that's a perfect way to end this podcast. And I hope that people are listening to what you have to say, Kaylin. And if you are a DNC member and you do have a vote for this, vote for Kaylin Free for vice chair. You will never be sorry. And take that from somebody that's known her for a very, very long time. So I want to thank you, Kaylin, for being on the show. And as always, Liberty, for adding so much. And we always end the show with a song that we dedicate to the person that was on the show. We always play out with the song. And I know, Kaylin, that like me, you're a big Willie Nelson fan.
Yeah.
So here's one of my favorites from Merle Haggard and Willie. Here's Poncho and Lefty, a song about friendship, a song about integrity. And I'm proud to call you my friend, Kaylin. And I know what a great person you are. So I hope people vote for you. We'll see you next week,
thank
folks.
Thank you so much.
Vote for Kaylin.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.